Okay, since you all know me, I don't think I need any introduction, and this is supposed to be informal discussion. Originally, it was planned for Wednesday, so for some reason it got moved to Thursday, so I hope that the shift is not going to affect informal setup of our conversation. I'll try to review some tools that are available, at least to my knowledge, for constructing realistic models of particle physics using M-theory on G2 manifolds. So that's the subject. And I hope that Gordy or somebody else will take over at some point and bring in more techniques or questions that are available on the market at present. And myself, I'll just focus on fairly old developments, at least all by string theory standards, something that's been happening, say, 2 or 3 years ago. So first, let me review what G2 manifolds are and why this is an interesting approach to particle physics, to string phenomenology. G2 refers, well, G2 is an exceptional Lie group of rank 2, dimension 14. It's very remarkable among Lie groups. It has many interesting properties, but many of those will not be important to us today. So why manifolds are labeled by or have the name attached to this group? So the reason is that it's a way of characterizing the level of the extent to which a manifold is curved. And if you imagine a manifold X of dimension, say, n, then you can imagine the following process. You can take a vector on this manifold and imagine a parallel transport of this vector along a closed loop gamma, and once you come back to the point where you started, the vector most likely is not going to come to its original orientation. It's guaranteed by remaining geometry that it will have the same length, but orientation may be different due to the fact that there is some curvature in this on this manifold. And therefore, you can ask, what is the relative orientation of this vector if I try to traverse all possible loops on a curved space X? Okay, so naturally, we can parameterize such angles by group elements of SOM, again, where n is dimension of the manifold. And generically, if our manifold has generic metric, then all elements of SON can be realized in this way. Okay. So then manifolds of special holonomy are such that only subgroup of SON can be realized by holonomies of this parallel transport. And this group, the subgroup of SON, is usually denoted hol of X. And it sits inside SON, and in fact can be all of SON. Okay. So for a simple example is, if you take n-dimensional sphere, SN, then holonomy group of SN is indeed all of SON. So according to this classification, sphere is curved in the most generic way, even though it looks round to us, for example, with a round metric. So Calabi-Yau's, which we use for compactifications of type 2 theories, have special or reduced holonomy, which is SU3, and that sits inside SO6. So these are six real dimensional manifolds, but three complex dimensional manifolds, and the corresponding holonomy group is smaller. And G2 manifolds are likewise manifolds of real dimension 7. So from now on, I'm going to focus on case where dimension of X is 7. In this case, in general, holonomy could be SO7, according to this rule. So if I take generic 7-dimensional manifold, put generic metric on it, the holonomy will be SO7, but if a metric is chosen appropriately, such that holonomy group of X is actually G2, it could sit inside SO7. Then we'll say that the manifold has G2 holonomy, or we'll call it a G2 manifold. Okay. Any questions so far? Good. So of course this is a very inefficient way of characterizing G2 manifolds, because if you're given one, most often you don't know the metric, and anyway you're not going to look at the whole infinite dimensional space of such holonomies, such loops. That's just ridiculous. So there should be a more efficient way to characterize this manifold. And again, analogy with Calabi-Yau's will be a good guide. So first thing I want to note is that these manifolds that we're going to consider are not complex manifolds. So many tools of algebraic geometry will not be available to us. Nevertheless, analogy with Calabi-Yau's is somewhat useful. So in the case of Calabi-Yau's, we know that Calabi-Yau is a manifold which is Keller in particular. It has complex structure and Keller structure, and has a trivial canonical bundle, which means that apart from Keller form omega, it also has holomorphic 3 form capital omega. Okay. So in particular, if we use this for string compactifications, a little omega, or sometimes called J, and capital omega always come in. We compute some kind of periods, and so on and so forth. So likewise, the manifold of G2 holonomy can be characterized by existence of some forms. So the fact, which I can make look a little bit more formal by calling it a theorem, is that a manifold X has G2 holonomy if and only if there exists a 3 form called associative 3 form such that it's closed d phi equals 0, as well as d star phi equals 0. Okay? So this will play a very special role in compactifications on G2 manifolds, just like Keller form and holomorphic 3 form play in compactification on Calabi-Yau spaces. The slight difference, though, is that here they are completely disentangled in a sense that locally, for example, the moduli space is a product of Keller deformations and deformations of complex structure, which sit here and here, respectively. But as you may notice, here I'm using, there is only one 3 form, and the 4 form is actually a Hodge dual of the 3 form. So this tor is the Hodge dual operation. So in a sense, there is only one 3 form. However, it may suggest in the meantime that there should be a special role played by 3 cycles and 4 cycles, just like here we have 2 cycles whose volume is controlled by Keller structure, and 3 cycles whose volume is measured by the holomorphic 3 form. Analogy goes a little further. Here, for example, if you think of mirror symmetry, the volume of 2 cycles receives Wolschmidt instanton corrections and is quantum, therefore, but it's equal to classical volume of a 3 cycle in the mirror Calabi-Yau. And in fact, something similar actually happens here, even though there is only one associative 3 form. 3 cycles in G2 manifolds will be quantum. They'll receive corrections, but due to membranes, because we'll be dealing with M theory, and volumes of 4 cycles will be classical. So therefore, this analogy with Calabi-Yau's is more or less solid. Okay, so.
Finally, are there general statements about the one-engine cycle?
In G2 manifold?
Yeah.
So we'll be dealing, actually, even in stating this theory, I suppress the condition that it's all on the assumption that it's simply connected. And let's see. Two cycles are there. So, right. So, since you asked about topology, what shall I do? Let me relegate it for a second. I'll come back to it in just a moment. All right.
Do you have any permission to provide these are equivalent statements? The existence of this
tree? Oh, no, that's a non-trivial statement. And I can. Yeah, I can do the following. So it's actually quite miraculous because, well, first of all, if you have a metric of G2 holonomy, locally it's very easy to go back and forth, to go either one direction or the other. So for instance, locally any manifold can be written, well, metric on any manifold can be written in terms of frames. So let G be EA one times EA, where A runs from 1 to 7, be the set of frames, then locally the 3, 4, and phi can be constructed as follows. It's 1 over 3 factorial for normalization, then some set of coefficients, I'll call them psi ABC, EA, wedge EB, wedge EC. So all of these are 1 form, so together they give us a 3 form. And if I choose psi ABC, so here psi ABC take values plus minus 1 or 0, and these are structure constants of imaginary octonions. So octonions form an algebra OA times OB with minus delta AB plus psi ABC OC. Just like quaternions, but there are 8 of them. And if I use these psi's, which are plus minus ones or zeros, just a bunch of integers, as coefficients here, then this phi is going to be associative 3 form. So given a metric, I can bring it, well, most often it comes already in this form. So I can just use plus minus ones to assemble a 3 form out of Weilbein components. Yes?
I'm wondering if the simplest explanation is one that might satisfy Marty is the one involving the spinner. Namely, if you look at SO7, you look at the subgroup under which the spinner is invariant, that's G2, and so you can take that spinner and form a 3 form by the usual.
Yeah, sandwiching gamma matrix.
Here, the spinner would be gamma and then T in the middle. And that's it.
Right. What's remarkable, actually, is that you can go backwards. Here, there is almost no statement about the metric, barring some minor comment about this Hodge star operator. So if you're given a 3-form, a closed and co-closed 3-form on a 7-dimensional manifold, you're not saying much about the metric. You're not saying much about holonomy or curvature. So what's remarkable is that this process that I just described here locally can be inverted. So if you're given a 3-form, you can actually write the candidate metric G.
You need some non-degeneracy assumption.
G of phi. Right. You need some non-degeneracy condition on this phi, that's right, but it's a condition that that this phi is roughly generic. So therefore I feel confident suppressing it.
So is there more than one metric you can choose given that free form such that your manifold is actually G2?
Locally it's unique, but globally, it may not even exist, even if locally it does. So these are already tricky questions. So here maybe is a good time to say that there is no analog, for instance, of Yau's theorem. And that's the, one of the major obstacles in dealing with these guys. So when we talk about compactification on Calabi-Yau, we never write the metric. We just specify Hodge numbers. And then talk very confidently about spectrum of particles, doublet triplet splitting, and so on and so forth. Here, and until we have some guarantee that such a manifold exists, which is usually done on case-by-case basis, there is no generic statement like Gauss theorem which would do it for us, unfortunately. Now, how do we want to construct such manifolds and classify them? Steve already asked about topology. So, as I say, from now on, and in fact throughout the whole talk, let me assume that it's simply connected. So at most I'll allow some discrete group to be the fundamental group of our space X. And then if X is compact, then we don't have too much freedom, at least for Betti numbers. So the Betti numbers could be B0, which is 1, because I'm considering just one component of this space X. Then B1, which is 0 by assumption, B2, B3, B4, B5, B6, and B7. Well, B7 is also 1. B6 is 0 by Poincaré duality from B1, and B4 is the same as B3, and B5 is the same as B2. Okay, so there are only two, in just from Poincaré duality, you see that there are only two integers which at least topologically characterize G2 manifolds, very much like H11 and H21. Is what we usually send to our friend over email if you want to specify which Calabi-Yau we're talking about. So here, B2 and B3 play the same role.
So before you go on, since you are going to restrict the semi-connected case for the rest of your talk, can you just say a few words about, is the non-semi-connected case interesting? Or is it, I mean, is it something that we ignore for physical reasons, or just because it's hard and complicated and we want to do what we can?
Well, I think if B1 is non-zero, then it's actually always a product, or at least locally a product, of Calabi-Yau cross R. And that's...
Cross R?
Yeah. Yeah. Or cross S1, I mean locally cross R. And that's what makes such cases usually uninteresting. I don't know if there is any other example of that sort which has non-trivial B1 and still irreducible holonomy, namely something which is... not smaller than just G2 itself.
So is it possible that if it's actual G2 holonomy, then B1 has to be zero?
Yeah, I think that's, at least locally, that's, well, sorry. If it has...
yeah.
B1 isometry, that's...
The covariant constant, so.
Right. Right, if it has U1 isometry, then that's a result of your former colleague, Robert Bryan, right? And I think the corresponding statement also is true for compact ones, but I don't know whom to attribute to.
In compact case, I think it follows from Shiger and somebody, I can't remember who, which tells you that when you have vector fields, there's some mm-hmm. finite cover, which is splits as a product of a torus.
Yeah.
The whole element is reducible.
So it may be also in that same paper by Bryan, actually. Right, so therefore in this business, usually this is the most generic sorting case where you have only two integers, B2 and B3, specifying the topological type of the space we're considering. Now, constructing this manifolds is usually a hard job, so let me just give you an illustration of how that goes. By the way, I should say that, for instance, on R7, there is an obvious G2 structure. By the way, the term G2 structure usually refers to either metric of G2 holonomy or more often to this side of the correspondence, which is more useful, namely the three-form, the associative three-form phi. So in the case of R7, so we can choose the frames to be just DXA, where these are usual Cartesian coordinates on R7, and then this will be a G2 structure. but very simple one, the flat one. Of course, on R7 there are many G2 structures, many independent ones, and that's related to the fact that there are many supersymmetries. All supersymmetries are preserved by convective ion and flat spin. Now, you can use this type of example. It obviously generalizes also to T7. I don't have to do much to just replace one-forms DXA by the corresponding one-forms on a torus to construct G2 structures on a 7 torus. But then we can do the following. We can sort, say, with T7, which has a holonomy group completely trivial. So holonomy of T7 is just identity, because no matter which path you choose, homologically, homotopically trivial or non-trivial on a 7 torus, the vector doesn't rotate at all if you choose a flat metric, which I most often do. But then you can do the following. You can choose a group gamma, which is a discrete subgroup in SO7, and more specifically in G2, and consider and form a quotient of T7 mod gamma, and then try to resolve the singularities if that's possible. And this is the orbifold construction of a 7-dimensional manifold. So example of it due to Joyce, in fact, some of the first few examples came from Dominic Joyce, where, say, gamma is product of three Z2 groups, Z2 cross Z2 cross Z2, acting on a 7-dimensional torus in a certain way. If you want, I can give you details, but it's probably not so important. What I want to say, though, is that in order to compute, we can easily compute cohomology of this quotient, or the resolution of this quotient, to find the Betti numbers of x, b2, and b3, which would put this particular example on the map of all smooth G2 manifolds. So idea of Dominic was that let's look at simple singularities, and that's why here gamma consists of several Z2 factors, such that each Z2 acts locally as each orbifold, each Z2 action is modeled on C2 mod Z2, which is the usual AD singularity. Okay, then we know that this can be resolved into smooth LE space. I'll call it LE of type A1 for Z2 singularity, which is completely non-singular, right? And locally, it looks like it's a 4 real dimensional space, which is non-compact, asymptotically looks like R4, and has a non-trivial 2 cycle in it. So, in fact, in one of the syntactic structures, I can label it as cotangent bundle of a 2 sphere. So it's isomorphic too. Yeah. Now, this is an example of a singularity that's familiar to us from algebraic geometry. Well, this example is complex. But now what we can do is we can take Z2 groups acting on a 7 torus, so that locally each of the Z2s acts only on 4 of the coordinates on a 7 torus, and precisely in the same way as a Z2 acts here on the C2 by changing the sign of 2 complex variables. So if we do this, that's the example I'm considering, then there are 12, in this case, there are 12 singularities, or 12 fixed points, or rather fixed point sets, of gamma, each of which is of the form R4 cross T3 mod Z2, where Z2 acts only on R4, so that's I can also write it as C2 mod Z2 times T3. So what it says is that there are 12 copies of tori, 3 tori, sitting in the 7-dimensional torus that we started with, such that each of the 3 tori has normal bundle of the form of A1 singularity. Okay. Now, in order to compute the homology of the resulting space, if we do this resolution locally near each singularity, what we have to do is we have to take, well, we want to compute B2 of x and B3 of x, and this consists of B2 of original torus, but now gamma invariant part of that, plus something that comes from resolution of these singularities, and similarly here it's going to be B3 of T7 gamma invariant part plus something which comes from resolution of singularities, so it will be 12 times something and 12 times something. So the answer for this particular guy is that this is 0, this is actually 7. So that's not hard to work out. Again, I'm not giving you the explicit form of this group in terms of generators, but this is usually the easy part because all you have to do is to, well, the homology of a 7 torus is very easy to work out, and then you just scan through list of all the forms and see which of them are invariant under this group. And then we have to take into account the contribution of 12 tori, which consists of this fixed points of the form C2 mod Z2 times the torus. And here the following is going on. It's easier to look at B5, actually, which is supposed to be the same as B2.
Excuse me, I'm confused.
Yeah.
C2 mod Z2 compact?
C2 mod Z2 is non-compact.
Don't you start out with a complex space?
Right, so idea is that you have a big torus. Oops, it's a 7-dimensional torus. I can't really draw it, but it looks like this. And then it has a bunch of fixed points. I want to figure out what's is it possible to construct a metric of G2 holonomy by repairing these bad points with something smooth. And then the answer is affirmative because singularities are all of the type that we already know how to repair in Calabi-Yau's. So what Dominic Joyce does is that he uses that technique and then shows that everything goes well with respect to G2 holonomy and they can be patched in in this local region without and the globally metric exists. So that's the result he proved. And now I'm trying to figure out what would be, say, the topology of the resulting space by taking into account contribution of all these fixed points.
So you patch these regions up with some non-compact...
Yeah, right. So I just excavate part of the space around the singularity, excavate the singular part and replace it with something smooth. And then try to glue it together in a smooth way so that the whole thing
is...
The
volume is still finite?
Yeah, right. So I can do it in a very small region just around the singularity by resolving just a little bit of it. And then I'm not really removing much of the volume because original torus had flat metric on it. And obviously, there is not much volume contained in a small region just around the singularity.
He's just looking at the local behavior of the singularity.
Yeah. I understand. Right. I'm just confused by having it replaced by something which is non-compact.
But you're not gluing the whole non-compact
part.
You're not.
Yes.
just patching it up a little.
The only really interesting part of C2 mod Z2 is near the origin. So it is just using that region near the origin and sort of clearing it into.
Right. And okay, so therefore, right. So to take right. So from untwisted sectors, we have contribution 0 and 7 respectively, and now we have to add contribution of this 12 fixed tori. In order to do this, all I have to do is just to look at contribution of one of them. And since fixed tori, each fixed tori is of the form C2 mod Z2 times T3, resolution of this singularity will give me something of the form LE1 cross T3. That's desingularization of this space. And as I said, this guy has only one interesting cycle, which is the cycle of dimension 2, and then we have tensor product with the three torus. So it's very easy to find what the Betti numbers of this space is. For example, the fifth Betti number is equal to 1, because that's the largest possible you can have by taking B3 of a three torus and B2 of LE space. Okay, so therefore B2 is 1. B5 is 1. That's this guy. And B3, which is the same as B4, is actually 3 by the same reasoning. So in order to have compute, say, B4 of this non-compact space, I have to look, I have to take B1, so B2 of this guy and B2 of this, but this is equal to 3. So and if I add everything together, I guess what comes out is that it's 12, 14, 3. Okay? So that's one of the famous G2 manifolds with Betti numbers B2 equals 12, again using concurrent duality back and forth, and B3 equals 43. So that's one of the examples constructed by Joyce by patching local singularities of the familiar type with LE space. Now, coming back to physics, so let's look at, once we're a little bit familiar with geometry and topology of the spaces, let's try to look at compactification of M-theory on G2 manifolds. So again, I assume that X is compact and has holonomy G2. Then, since it's seven-dimensional, we end up in four-dimensional world. And the fact that manifold has G2 holonomy translates to the fact, can be stated differently as existence of a coherently constant spinner. In fact, only one of them, which means that we're dealing with n equals 1 minimal supersymmetry in four dimensions. And the question is, what is this four-dimensional effective field theory that we get in this way? Already, this fact that we get a four-dimensional physics with n equals 1 supersymmetry is precisely one of the reasons which makes compactification of M-theory on G2 manifold a very sexy candidate for constructing realistic models of particle physics, because M-theory is known to be very geometric, and all the statements here, you don't have to deal with gauge bundles of heterotic string or things like that. Everything is going to be controlled just by geometry. So.
Is it called Yamcha's interval, G2, is that a special case?
It's a special case, but it's reducible. So. Holonomy is definitely inside G2, but it's smaller. It's in SU3 sitting inside G2.
How about if they're moving the product brains off of the end? Does it become more generic then?
But then it's not just.
So it's not
Yeah, it's not just geometry because we have the four form. Right. This has no four form flux in M3. So if you start moving five brains, then it will translate to some amount of four form flux, which is good because at some point we can make it more complicated and introduce that too. So it's all on the same this Dierksen diagram of vacuum. So. For a moment, just staying with the geometry, question is, okay, what could this effect of physics be? If X is compact, it will definitely have n equals 1 supergravity as part of it. Then it's actually not hard to work out what the rest of spectrum is, assuming that X is smooth, for instance. So in M theory, here on top, we have scalar fields in the low energy approximation, which are the metric and the free form, the antisymmetric tensor of rank 3. Then, upon Kolodziejczyk reduction, we get some components of these forms by decomposing them into harmonic forms on space X. And let me skip metric for a second, which is responsible for supergravity. And since I know that it's already there, I won't worry about it. And just look at the three form, okay? So three form is has three legs in physics notation. So if you want to write it, it has three indices. So you can decompose it into, two form along manifold X and one form in the non-compact space, which I'm assuming to be R4. So we are on Minkowski space, R4 or R3, 1 times X. So this C field can be decomposed into two form along X, and then it will be a one form, or put differently, vector field or gauge field in the four-dimensional space. So this tells us, since there are B2 two forms along X, homological two forms, we have B2 vector multiplets. N equals 1 vector multiplets as a result of such complexification. Now, another possibility is just to have all legs of the C field to be along X and namely decompose this three form in a basis of three forms on X, and there are B3 of those. So we have B3 real scalars coming from the C field. Okay. So something is wrong here because those of us who know N equals 1 supersymmetry would immediately complain that there aren't any multiplets which have B3 real scalars and nothing else. They should come either with tensors or other scalars. So the most natural choice is to have, B3 complex scalars, which compose into N equals 1 chiral multiplets. Which tells us that we should expect, in fact, B3 Kolodziejczyk harmonics coming from the metric. Okay, so even without knowing much about geometry of G2 manifolds, you infer that moduli space of G2 manifolds or moduli space of G2 matrix on X should have dimension equal to B3 of X in order for this to make any sense. So that's a physics way, if you wish, of rediscovering this fact, which mathematicians can derive using the Nesnerovich operators and the usual techniques of differential geometry.
I mean, you could have had more moduli which paired up. So.
Yeah, but it doesn't happen. So. So this is the spectrum, and what's interesting is that if X is smooth, which was assumption all along, then these vector multiplets are in fact contain a billion gauge fields, and these chiral multiplets are not charged with respect to this U1 gauge field. So it's a very boring effective field theory. If you have generic G2 manifold, smooth one, something that mathematicians want to construct, you don't get a very interesting physics out of it. So in fact, to get interesting physics, we have to go back and consider singular G2 manifolds. That's where, as I alluded earlier, here everything is very geometric. So if you want some new interesting physics, the source of new physics should probably come from interesting geometries, and those are singular geometries. Well, as physicists, we obviously expect this to be the case. We're on the right track.
Well, yeah, how do you match? You're using the three-form.
Well, it's just the same type of statement that, for example, for Calabi-Yau's deformations of complex structure can be are in one-to-one correspondence with elements of H2-1.
Yeah, here you use a complex structure.
And here you use associative structure in a similar sense. So,
yeah,
see,
I
claimed earlier that G2 metric is effectively described by specifying a 3-form. So how many variations of the 3-form we could possibly have? Probably labeled by B3. So. That's a heuristic argument, but it's actually approximation to the correct argument.
But for example, if I wanted a formula, say, given a...
Oh, yeah, there is a formula. Right. This statement is analogous to the formula you're asking, that you can actually describe very precisely deformations of G2 structure in terms of basis of the H3.
But Steve, remember in the Calabi-Yau case, the formulas would have told you sort of how to deform the complex structure, or maybe the Kähler class, but they don't tell you how the metric itself deforms, right? You have to kind of invoke Yau's theorem
to
know directly how the metric deforms.
Now, M theory has a low energy limit, which is a lot of dimensional supergraph.
Mm-hmm.
We expect there to be lots of higher order corrections. And normally, in a singular, near a singular point, we worry that the geometric description is breaking down.
Right.
So is there a reason here why we can trust the physics you're about to describe in the singularities as being relevant for M theory if we don't understand all higher order corrections?
No, that's precisely one of the main issues. So I hope by now I convinced you that one of the two major problems in this business is A, constructing such manifolds or somehow trying to assert their existence. And second is cases interesting to us are usually singular ones. For instance, Joyce was starting with a singular space and was trying to resolve it, but as a physicist, you would say, no, stop there. It's good enough. We want something singular. Now we're coming back to the main question here, that one of the main goals is to understand the physics of singularities. So that's, of course, with all our tools and hoping that we can actually trust the results.
Excuse me, does the analysis that you're doing here, does that also describe the case of, say, 11-dimensional supergravity with 10-dimensional boundaries with E8 on them? Or is this totally different class?
No, it's a different class. Here I'm assuming that we can view boundary as a kind of singularity of G2 manifold. So it, in a very broad sense, it is. But, for instance, it wasn't part until so far because I was assuming that X is compact and smooth. So now I'll be allowing some singular behavior inside X. And if singularity is of codimension 1, namely the boundary, then we'll get precisely to the setup that you want. Well, I don't know, so we'll see. So here I'm just merely concluding that if I don't introduce any singularities, I'm doomed in the sense of reconstructing interesting model of particle physics. So for a smooth G2 manifold, we're not getting anything realistic.
Okay.
got to do better. Okay, now the problem of constructing G2 manifolds and studying singularities are not unrelated because as a start, we don't even know what kinds of singularities are allowed and what could be that. Okay? So first to rectify the situation a little bit and to, address this somewhat disappointing conclusion, I should quickly say that at least one type of singularity we already encountered, and this is a singularity where X locally looks like, say, C2 mod gamma, where gamma is a discrete subgroup of SU2 classified by AD or E type times R3. And by the way, since now the focus is shifting to studying singularities, local behavior will be always good enough. So I don't have to worry about compactness of the space or do this pasting of these patches into compact manifold like Joyce did, because now the goal is to understand what the physics of a singularity is. And for that type of question, we as physicists usually assume that behavior of the geometry far away from singularity should not affect the physics associated to behavior of the physics at the singular point.
So this is a statement that the only kinds of singularities must look like this?
No. This is a statement that, this is already one kind of singularity that we've seen before, which was already used in Joyce construction. And we actually know what this gives rise to, say, from duality between M-theory on K3 and heterotic on T3, where K3 develops one of the singularities. We expect the physics to have extra gauge degrees of freedom, namely non-abelian gauge symmetry with gauge group of the corresponding ADE type, which is SUN for ZN, SP for, SO for dihedral group and exceptional groups for the E series. And here the gauge degrees of freedom come from C2 mod gamma singularity, and in fact the gauge bosons sit in the seven-dimensional space, which is our four-dimensional Minkowski space, across this R3, which is the patch parallel to the singularity. So the way geometry looks is that there is R3, or some three-dimensional space, I'll call it Q, which locally looks like R3, and then transverse to it, there is a locus of C2 mod gamma singularities, and the gauge degrees of freedom live on seven-dimensional space, which is Q times the Minkowski space. So, in fact, we didn't have to go all the way back to, we didn't have to compactify all the way to four dimensions to discover this gauge degrees of freedom. And this is something familiar to us from old days of dualities, which go even further to mid-90s, yeah.
Are those membranes that become light from the singularity?
Right, these membranes are precisely the components of non-abelian structure gauge bosons arising at part of the spectrum of this non-abelian theory and the singularity. Right. So there, as I say, there are many ways to see this non-abelian physics, and I don't think I should focus on this because it's not the meat of this subject. You can either use duality with heterotic string, or type 2 string, where it will be in terms of the six brains. Actually, the six brain analogy is good because I was going to use something related. C2 mod gamma admits some circle action, and you can take that circle to be M3 circle in this local model, compactify, and then what you find is indeed precisely what Sean is saying, that you'll have stack of D6 brains, flat D6 brains in flat 10-dimensional space. That's equivalent physics to this situation.
That works for A, and for D you need an O6 plane, but
for A, right. But if I use duality with hydraulic string, all ADs go.
So it is just six brains. It has nothing to do with, say, graph.
No, but then strings which are becoming light or membranes, if you include this extra circle. So it has, because string is membrane on a circle, it has to do with membranes, depending how you look at it.
Right.
Now we have to be very careful. That's right, because what we want to do is we want to have take this as a bare bone construction of some n equals 1 four-dimensional physics, which among other things will have gravity that we need. But now we have to ameliorate it with interesting degrees of freedom, such as non-abelian gauge physics, chiral matter, charge under this gauge group, and hopefully some other realistic features. So for this, we're going to, at least in this first example of singularities, we can borrow something from Calabi-Yau's, where locally physics has more supersymmetries, and we understand it much better from across the duality board from all different perspectives, and can be fairly confident. But this is the question that Gary asked. Every time we deal with a singularity, we have to be sure that physics is as what we expect. So claim is that physics of a G2 manifold, which locally has gamma ADE singularity, has gauge degrees of freedom. And I think that's a fairly safe statement because, again, it's modeled on something that's not even pertinent to G2, but may be found in other geometries. Again, assuming that local physics is not affected by global behavior.
Kind of by definition, when you get to the case of interest, which will have n equals 1 chiral matter, there will be no duality frame where there's extended supersymmetries and such matter couldn't arise. So eventually, you have to face up to this question, how you really know what
right.
the singularity is. So for that case,
right. So let's wait. Let's see. In fact, that's precisely the next type of example. Now we want to do something else. Gauge degrees of freedom is not a big deal because, again, we could have them from geometry in many different ways, and ADE singularities is a particular way how we can construct them, even in K3 compactifications, not just G2. So this is precisely what's going on here. It's not that surprising. All I'm saying is that now you can consistently embed it in G2 manifold by taking some three-cycle Q sitting inside our compact manifold X and arranging the normal directions, the normal bundle in the mathematical terms, to this three-manifold Q to be of the type of to be of this type, C2 mod gamma AD or R4 mod gamma AD. That's a way to construct gauge degrees of freedom. So we can definitely improve on this. But what we want is to construct also chiral matter, which is charged on the gauge group. And for this, we need some other singularities. What kind of singularities could do the job? It's actually easy to convince oneself that we have to go all the way to singularities of codimension 7 in a 7-dimensional G2 manifold. Why? Because every kind of physics which arises from singularity of smaller codimension could be discovered in high-dimensional gauge theory. For instance, here we found some gauge degrees of freedom, okay, and they're localized, they arise from singularities of codimension 4. So the C2 mod gamma is a singularity, it's a point in the 4-dimensional space, so it's codimension 4, which is consistent with the fact that the gauge degrees of freedom can be found in high dimensional gauge theories, I mean, of dimension 5, 6, and even 7, but that's already very peculiar. But chiral matter is something that does not come from dimensional reduction of a, say, five-dimensional theory, okay? So, in fact, that's the, if you wish, the definition of the world chiral, that it cannot be lifted to five dimensions. Therefore, locally, the singularity cannot be of the form, or M times some singular space of dimension 7 minus M, if M is positive. Because any singularity of this form will not give a chiral matter. It will, it can be lifted effectively to five-dimensional physics. So what we want is singularity of maximal chi dimension, something that will not arise from a high-dimensional theory. That's already puts us in this extreme situation where we're considering something which can only occur in n equals 1 four-dimensional physics. So this says that we have to look at isolated.
So just to back up, is it in principle impossible to take some non-chiral matter and give half of it a mass by some global effect? I mean, really, it has to be a local construction of chiral matter?
That's a very contrived scenario you're suggesting. I don't know. Maybe the answer is yes, but it's, you see, it's quite tricky. Definitely not from a local construction, because
right.
From what I've just said, but
it may or not be principle.
Yeah, we don't have good control over global behavior of GT metrics, and that's why I think such questions are even further away than in the case of Calabi-Yau. So
they have to be isolated, though, right?
Hmm?
It doesn't have to be isolated.
Oh, okay, right. In fact, it won't be. So. In the simple example I was going to describe, it would be isolated, but then I was going to patch, right. By the time we try to put everything together, it won't be isolated. So, co-dimension 7 singularity is our candidate for constructing chiral matter and possibly other sources of interesting physics. So, such singularities, examples of such singularities might be conical singularities, where metric locally looks as follows. As usual, ds squared is dr squared plus r squared, and then metric on some six-dimensional space, which I'll call y. Here it's the base of the cone, and our space x looks like this. If y is a six-dimensional sphere, then x is going to be just R7 and non-singular, but if y is anything else other than the sixth sphere, then x has a conical singularity at the origin. And the question is, what is the physics of the singularity? In order for x to be, at least in this class of examples, in order for x to have G2 holonomy, space y has to satisfy certain properties, namely, it should have so-called weak SU3 holonomy. It's a condition analogous to Einstein-Sasaki condition in five dimensions that we know from examples of conical singularities in Calabi-Yau, just like a cone on Einstein-Sasaki 5 space gives a Calabi-Yau singularity. In the same way, cone on weak SU3 holonomy manifold gives a singular G2 geometry. Okay. Some condition that you can write in terms of metric and curvature. So.
Is that the same as SU3 structure, or is it more than that?
No, it's more than that. SU3 structure is a much more relaxed condition than this. This basically is relaxing the condition that a Ricci curvature is zero. It basically says that that's proportional to the metric, whereas SU3 structure is much more general than that. Okay, I'm not going to do the whole general theory simply because it doesn't exist. Now, this is the place where, as you see, this is the most interesting source of physics for us. But on the other hand, that's precisely where the general theory does not exist. And we have to study such isolated singularities, sorry, co-dimension 7 conical singularities or other singularities of co-dimension 7 on case-by-case basis. So familiar examples are, which have been studied, include, for instance, among other things, six manifolds Y of the Cassie 3 holonomy, which are, say, CP3. CP3 is a simplest example of weak SU3 holonomy space. Another example would be the homogeneous quotient space SU3 mod its maximal torus, which is U1 times U1. And another example would be, say, S3 cross S3, just to name a few.
This singularity is able to move around. Anything lives there is able to move around in Minkowski space.
Right, right.
Couldn't you get from that construction, then just do some overfolding of that R3 to get down to something that looks like this?
Actually, the answer, yeah, the answer is yes, but surprisingly, it hasn't been analyzed. So, in fact, maybe it's a good point to mention that. You may try to do even before, well, conical singularities are a particularly nice class of singularities that we usually have, but another class that we should definitely explore is of the form R7 mod gamma, where gamma is a discrete subgroup of G2, just like we did, say, for C2 mod gamma. And if it's sits in G2 but cannot be embedded in any smaller subgroup such as SU3, that's precisely what we want. It will give us some physics which can be encountered only in n equals 1 four-dimensional theory, and that will be good enough. Surprisingly, it hasn't been studied, even compactification of type 2 theory, where we can use CFT techniques, can be used to learn at least something about physics of such quotient singularities. So I have a list of such subgroups and some ideas what should happen for some of them. So if there are interested graduate students, I'd be glad to suggest this as a homework problem. So this is one of the missed opportunities in the past. But at least for conical singularities, in some cases, the answer is known, and they have been studied. So let me tell you briefly what happens and what kind of phenomena we expect. So in generally, when space becomes singular, we should expect some new degrees of freedom, new symmetries appearing from as the singularity develops, or possibly some topology-changing transitions or phase transitions where we go to the other branch in geometry. So for these two spaces, for instance, what happens is that the physics indeed is associated to some phase transitions, but of very different kinds. And each of the singularities can be resolved in three different ways. Therefore, the moduli space has three branches, but they look somewhat different between these two. This is an example precisely where we get some chiral matter. Okay, so let me focus on this one just as a model example. Again, there are some generalizations of all of these constructions. So if you take, again, this cone on CP3, then the first question is, can you resolve this into smooth space? Can you repair the singularity, smooth it out? And the answer is yes. In this case, what you can do is resolve it into non-compact space with the same asymptotic boundary conditions, which topologically looks like S4 cross R3. Okay. I mean, obviously, it's not metrically product. It's a non-trivial bundle over the force sphere, but that's what it looks like. And as here, there is one geometric parameter on this space, which controls the volume of the force sphere. And it turns out that if you look at the L2 normalizable forms, differential forms, cohomology of this non-convex space, then there is a normalizable three form, which means that there is a component of the C field which pairs up with this volume and therefore makes a complex modulus consistent with n equals 1 supersymmetry, which parameterizes the moduli space of such geometries. So the moduli space, therefore, looks like this. It's a complex plane, here decomposed into radial direction, parameterized by the volume, and the periodic direction, parameterized by the modes of the C field. And at every regular point in this moduli space, geometry is non-singular, is completely smooth, and therefore, according to our general conclusion, no interesting physics is there. But as singularity develops right here, if we take volume of the S4 to zero, something interesting happens, and we actually do get a chiral matter from this system. So how do we know this, and how do we trust the analysis of M-theory? So I'm not going to describe this in detail, but I'd rather illustrate it a general tool which can be used for this. So one way is to consider, try to look at U1 actions on the space X, circle actions, and then think of the circle as M-theory circle. It turns out that in this particular example, for this guy X, there is such a circle action which has, which gives S4 mod times R3 mod U1 is actually isomorphic to R6, to a six-dimensional space. So it's a reduction on some circle in this geometry, which completely gets rid of geometry, if you wish. Of course, it has some fixed points, otherwise the physics would be completely boring. And the fixed point set in this case is the following. So for this circle action, fixed point set is R3 union R3 sitting inside R6, which is the quotient. So what it looks like is we have three copies of this picture. So this is R2, see, isomorphic to R2, with two copies of R intersecting in the origin. And then the result of this quotient is this picture tensored with itself three times. So what it gives us is that the ambient space becomes R6 when we tensor it three times, and each of these lines gives a three-plane. So there are two three-planes, this one and this one, meeting at a point in R6. So therefore, the physical interpretation of this reduction on M-theory circle that I chose here is that we have two D6 brains, this D6 and this D6, intersecting at a point, and this is a familiar construction of chiral matter in the intersecting brain models. So in fact, the singularity of GT manifold, which is Conon CP3, is nothing but the geometric equivalent to this familiar construction. There are other ones for which I don't know brain model analogs, but then this is one of them.
What happens to the chiral matter that appears as you resolve the singularity? Somehow become massive, but that can be the case.
Yeah.
It can if you
fix the U1.
If you
fix
the U1.
Right, good. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So the other question I had is that part of the motivation was in M theory everything is geometric.
Mm-hmm.
But it looks like every time you want to actually understand physics, you have to resort to some string description where you can say what's happening.
Right, so the goal is to use dualities in all kinds of ways, and sometimes, I unfortunately can go to more elaborate constructions. I mean, this is the simplest example, and it happens to have brain model duals, but as I say, there are other types of singularities which you can understand using symmetries of the spaces. Usually, one, in order to make some progress, one is trying to use some symmetries of the space. For example, it's not an accident that all of this can be written as homogeneous quotient spaces, and it's very crucial to use the symmetries to analyze the singularities just within M-theory. You don't even have to know much about the dual model. So, in fact, the singularity I'm describing was analyzed by Atti and Witten in their paper, even without using the dual D6 brain construction. I mean, you can do it, but there are other ways to analyze that. So, just to summarize, therefore, how this toolbox of methods in G2 geometry looks for particle physics is that we have a compact space X, which locally has some kind of ADE singularity where the gauge group lives. So let me draw a cartoon of that. So let this be a big G2 manifold X. Then somewhere here, there is a free cycle, which is usually taken to be homology sphere Q. And the normal bundle to Q has the familiar type of C2 mod gamma AD singularity that gives a gauge group. And now if you want to add a Carl matter, you have to include some codimension 7 singularities, which may sit outside of the three-cycle Q, or may happen to sit right on top of it. And in this case, where it sits outside, you don't get charged Carl matter. You get some Carl matter, but it's not charged under this gauge group. And if codimension 7 singularities sit on the cycle Q, then it's charged under the gauge group. And now you can go further and further and try to refine this picture by asking, okay, what about the proton decay, for instance? How is that translated into geometry and all other questions? But this is the basics.
Can you say a little bit about Witten's embedding of the standard model?
Witten's embedding of standard?
Those two papers that put SU5 all singularities.
Well, to get SU5, the idea is usually to choose Q to be a 3-sphere or some length space, which is 3-sphere mod ZK. So the typical choice is Q to be S3 mod ZK. Then normal bundle to Q should be of the form C2 mod Z5. That's what's going to give us SU5.
Is it local or global construction?
No, these are constructions now of the form. Okay, we know enough about global geometry, at least enough to hope that it makes sense. That's the logic. Let's analyze the singularities, get the physics out of it, and then try to imagine that something like this is possible where we can put them together. Of course, now there is no proof that it exists, but it's quite likely that it does, as long as local constructions are reasonable and make sense.
Well, doesn't duality imply that some things like this do exist? That there must be some dual with a heterotic string that ought to have such an SU5 with some properties, right?
Right. For some of the models, you want to do this in irreducible G2 manifold and so on. So, I mean, usually we analyze this in a large volume, and by itself it does not have a nice dual in other description. In fact, I think by the time you start putting together several of these ingredients, we already, you know, dualities are good to analyze each individual building block, but when we try to put them together, I think the goal should be precisely the opposite, that let's rather hope that it can be done in large volume limit of a G2 manifold rather than in some dual.
There are anomalies which are allowed to flow to infinity, which would not be allowed.
Yeah.
I was going to say also, since SU5 has become the standard model, if you're interested in unification, I think it's sort of within G2, it sits most naturally where the G2, the various directions of the G2 are a little bit large and comes above in dimensional Planck scale, but there's no particular large dimension that would say that there's a nice weakly coupled heterotic dual in the supergravity limit of M theory up to the modulo of the singularities. You can play the sort of same games that Ed did for Herjavec-Witten and find that.
If you had a picture there where you had this co-dimension four singularity, and then your gauge fields living in seven dimensions, I mean, this is very analogous to what we were doing with compactifying four dimensions, making them small in heterotic span, right? EA cross EA compactifying four dimensions. See, this example is exactly equivalent if I took one of your gauge groups living in seven dimensions to be E6. Then it corresponds to the example I discussed. Then you have three, the E6 lives on a T3 cross four-dimensional Minkowski space, and then when you overfold that T3, you can imagine breaking it down either to the standard model or to Patty Salam or something like that, and then you have to check the spectrum to see if you get the same spectrum that we had. I see that very analogous to heterotic string construction.
Yeah, so actually, right, so this picture borrows very much from heterotic compactifications because there are several reasons to have this ZK quotient. For instance, one is to allow Wilson lines to break the gut group, and another is that it actually becomes a symmetry that you can use for doublet-triplet splitting. Another is that proton decay rate is suppressed depending on how you choose K and so on and so forth. So in fact, several things fit together. And some of them are borrowed pretty much directly from experience with heterotic string, as I said.
Just a comment. I mean, if you read Ed's paper on proton decay, there's something that's really interesting that comes up that rarely comes up in string theory, which is these matter fields are localized at points. And we don't really know microscopic M theory, but if the points are separated, any couplings between the matter fields involve propagation between the points, and so they're finite.
Mm-hmm.
But if you bring two of the matter fields together, so they're in some multiplet of larger symmetry groups that makes them sit at the same point, Ed actually found that in trying to compute proton decay in some of these examples, he encountered a UV divergence in his attempt to do the M theory calculation. And this is almost one of the only cases we have in string theory or M theory where there's a UV divergence that directly enters into a physical quantity. And he actually had to go to type 2 strings to regulate it and get some estimate for the answer. But it's actually true in this context that physically interesting things are right now UV divergent. And so there's actually room for surprises, which might be taken as a good thing.
Well, not in the simplest cases, right? I mean, but it's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting observation. And I don't know what separates these classes of examples where they do enter and then not. That's a good point.
Well, the UV divergence presumably comes because you're talking about a field theory and not a string theory.
Exactly. You're using the supergravity with the singularity. And if it's not cut off by separation, you just don't know what to do.
But so you have to find a UV completion of M theory.
Exactly.
Well, or 11D supergravity.
Whatever.
Which is the name of it.